Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, I bring you different experts, thought leaders, public figures, policymakers, activists and advocates, and health foodies of all kinds. We talk about the connection between your personal health and our total health environment, the health of our communities, the health of our neighborhoods, the health of our society, and the health of planet Earth. All of these things are interconnected to create the context for our personal health, our community health, the world's health, and life on Earth. So every week on Connect the Dots, we talk about different facets of this complex mosaic that makes up life on Earth and what we can do to support that and each other. Every week on the show, I typically begin by promoting activism or some advocacy effort, and this week we're just going to talk about one that happened in the past, just for a moment. This last weekend with Forward on Climate Change, 50,000 people came to Washington, D.C. to urge President Obama to stop the XL Keystone pipeline, as well as bring an end to fossil fuel use in order to help slow climate change on planet Earth and protect our habitat now into the future and for generations to come. That was an exceptional turnout, as they said at the event. The speakers, including Bill McKibben, who's been a guest on this show, and Reverend Lennox Yearwood, who's been a guest on this show, they said that the 50,000 that attended represented millions more, and I know that includes many of you listeners. So I just want to stop and pause, not that our activism ever ceases, but to kind of honor that great gathering and to look ahead to what more we can do to kind of help protect the Earth. On today's show, I'm delighted and honored to have a public servant, a public official, who has done yeoman service and continues to do it. He is New York State Senator Tony Avella. Welcome to Connect the Dots. I'm going to just take a pause to tell listeners just a little bit about your, the wonderful work you're doing on behalf of New York State.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome, Senator Avella. Great to have you with us.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much for your championing of New York's health, environment, water, and food. I have been following you from afar and, in fact, reporting on you as well. It's just been, and I quote you quite frequently, and so finally I was like, I wonder if we could actually get Senator Avella on the show, so I'm so delighted to have you with us today.
It's a pleasure.
And I also just want to note that I grew up in your district.
Really?
And yes, I did. And if I still lived in our old family house, which, you know, I don't and I haven't for many years, I would be your constituent, which would certainly be a blessing for me, I know.
Well, thanks.
But fortunately for all New Yorkers, both city and state, your dedication to reform, your integrity, your hard work, your courage in going where angels fear to tread benefits everyone in New York State. So I'll consider myself an honorary constituent.
Well, that's so nice of you to say that.
Today, Senator Avella, let's talk a little bit about government, because I think we're coming from an epoch where there are many things that people have taken for granted. We've, kind of grown up believing they're there for us. There's been some misinformation about them, and some of the things that we used to take for granted aren't as much as a shoo-in as we might have hoped. So there's a natural sense, I think, in relation to things like fracking or other forms of pollution or contamination or industrial activities that could have health impact, there's a sense that the government wouldn't allow it if it wasn't safe. That I think that's the basic misunderstanding that people, that many people have, from within government and for having been in government for such an extended time period. What's your perspective on that?
Well, Unfortunately, I think government is not as responsive as it should be. I previously, before I was ever elected to public office, worked for Ed Koch in the mayor's office in New York City. And I don't remember government acting the way it does today then. We spend most of our time fighting our own government to get satisfaction. And when it comes to the environment, I think most people would believe that, oh, government is acting in our best interest. The problem is that, and let's bring it sort of to an issue in terms of hydrofracking, where the oil and natural gas companies donate so much money to candidates running for office and incumbents, you know, that they are able to influence government in terms of relaxing regulations or not coming up with regulations. So sometimes we're not doing the right thing by the environment or the people of the state. And hydrofracking is probably the best example, where we could have hydrofracking in the state in the next couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And the impact, the negative impact of allowing hydrofracking to occur could be disastrous.
So when we watch, for example, and, you know, we don't have to single him out specifically, but when we watch Governor Cuomo or even President Obama or other legislators and policymakers who are kind of, you know, on the fence, like, for example, President Obama spoke, you know, we must take action on climate change, and then hardly had exhaled a breath before he said we want to do more oil and gas permits. And, you know, some people, you know, he kind of said it quickly under his breath, like some of one of those commercials, you know, where they tell you, here's the drug for you, and, you know, here are the symptoms. I'll kind of talk rapidly. So, you know, it's kind of like I feel that, you know, many of our public officials are genuinely well-intentioned and, you know, speak from the heart and care about the right things. But the difficulty for them, which is why I think we see people standing on one foot and then in the other foot and back on the one foot, is that to even maintain or be in public office, they are in a dependent position in terms of these large companies making donations.
And that's absolutely correct, especially at the state level where there's very little regulations and the amount of money that can be received by candidates and incumbents is huge. So one of the things I've talked about for a long, long time is the need for public financing of local elections, because the money that's being, you know, used by lobbying firms on behalf of, like, the oil and natural gas company is just so overwhelming. And unfortunately, there are both candidates and incumbents who know that they have to raise money to get reelected and sometimes pay more attention to the donor with that big check rather than their constituents. And it's, in my opinion, big money is the single most biggest ethical problem facing government today.
I would totally agree with that. Do we actually know what people are receiving? Are they honor bound to tell us, or is that a deep dark secret?
Well, in the state, yes. I mean, even though there are very loose regulations, every candidate incumbent has to file with the state board of elections and list their donations. the abuse comes, first of all. Excuse me. The abuse comes, first of all, in that the amounts that people can donate is huge. For example, if somebody wants to donate to me as a candidate, let's say, for reelection, you know, in a year and a half for the state Senate, the maximum amount is $10,300. That's a lot. And not only can individuals donate, but businesses and corporations can donate. And obviously that is an abuse unto itself. But also there are these loopholes to the law where you have independent expenditures, where groups want to lobby on behalf of an issue, and they don't figure into the expenditures or the donation limits. So they can do it on behalf of a candidate as long as they don't have direct contact with the candidate. So that's one of the big loopholes.
That is a big loophole. That's a real problem. And then if a politician like yourself, you know, is standing up for the public or public health and the environment on an issue like fracking, then these companies, in effect, you know, either they wouldn't want to fund you or you wouldn't want to be supported by them. So
correct.
This could actually take, you know, kind of represent a higher risk both to the honest officials and to the people who want to elect them come election time, because they're not going to have the funding to do the ads. And
that's absolutely correct. I know I'm not the best fundraiser in the world. I'm probably the only candidate that I know or elected official that I know that doesn't spend hours every week on the phone trying to raise money. I refuse to do that. But, for example, I've been a very critical person of the real estate industry in the city of New York, because the real estate industry donates so much money to candidates within the city, it really controls the agenda. And because I've been probably the most vocal critic, there's a whole section of fundraising that the real estate industry doesn't give to me, where they fund candidates, other candidates, and that's where they get most of their money from. So I'm at a total disadvantage because, one, they're not going to give it to me, and, two, there are a lot of them I wouldn't take from the money in the first place. Mm-hmm. So, you know, candidates who take very strong positions on behalf of the people on the right side, in most instances, actually hurt themselves in fundraising. So it becomes tough for a lot of independent, reform-minded candidates to actually raise the money to run for public office.
So that means that those of us who, as part of the activism of those who care passionately about their communities, their city, their region, you know, really need to come out in force and support candidates, you know, I would say, even whether or not you happen to reside in their district even, you know, really kind of recognize who are the champions of the issues and concerns that the public has.
I couldn't have said it better myself. That's what people have to start doing.
Mm-hmm.
Support those candidates that are trying to do the right thing, that are standing up, being independent, and taking very forceful positions instead of waiting to see which way the wind blows before mm-hmm. they actually get involved in an issue.
Right.
That would be very helpful, because then at the end of the day, we start electing more candidates to public office who are truly, you know, truly community-minded and good government people.
Mm-hmm. And they're not merely kind of reading, you know, a kind of talking point memo, you know, written by an outside lobbyist. They're really taking the time that they're not fundraising to, you know, inform themselves about the issue, as you have done. So, you know, and I've noted that. So let's get into the issue a little bit. You know, I've quoted you in a recent article. I'm always, you know, kind of thrilled because you're so quotable. I've quoted you in several recent articles. Because you really kind of drill into the essence and have a fantastic and succinct way of kind of distilling the essence of what a concern, you know, is, as well as standing up for it. So, you know, let's talk a bit about what's going on now in New York State, because you alluded to that as well. Can you give our listeners an update on where we stand with the prospect of fracking coming to New York State?
Well, there was a deadline that had been set up for the Department of Environmental Conservation to issue the regulations, the final sort of regulations, this month. Then they have they're not making the deadline. So what happens now? Now the Commissioner Martens has said that they could issue guidelines in the next couple of weeks. They're basically waiting for a so-called health analysis on the proposed regulations to allow hydrofracking. And when I say the so-called health analysis, they hired three scientists who are eminently qualified to review the health impacts based upon the study that DEC did. However, there's nothing in the study about a health analysis, or health impacts. So I actually said this at the budget hearings to the commissioner recently in the last couple of weeks. Well, you're asking the State Department of Health to review nothing in the report, and then you're asking these three scientists to review what the Department of Health is reviewing, which is nothing. So how could you possibly come up with any recommendations about the health impact? What I did previously in the last session was actually introduce a bill which was also passed in the assembly to require the state to do a comprehensive health impact analysis of what would happen if you actually did, you know, hydrofracking, with all the chemicals that are involved in this process and the danger of radioactive material that's being released from the ground into the water supply in the atmosphere. What are the health impacts? What are the costs to local municipalities that are going to have to deal with this? And to date, DEC has not done this. I mean, it's it's incredulous that we could do such a dangerous practice in the state without fully analyzing this. The other aspect of it is we haven't analyzed the seismic impacts. Because that hydrofracking has gone on in other states, we now have a history of what's happened. And the health impacts are tremendous. And now we know that there are seismic impacts where certain in certain states, the EPA and the Geological Society of the United States have actually determined that some minor earthquakes have been caused by hydrofracking. Now, we've been very lucky in New York State not to have a major earthquake, but we do have fault lines. So, and because we've never had a major earthquake, there aren't really strict regulations on buildings, on how to build them that are earthquake resistant. So we can't afford to have the increased likelihood of a major earthquake. So you have the lack of a health impact assessment. You have the seismic impact issue. And now I've also found out that other than OSHA, there were really no regulations that cover safety, worker safety, or worker training on these sites throughout the entire state, which is fascinating. And there's no requirement that there be union members or that they be that they go through an approved Trentis program. And I think your listeners also have to recognize most of these jobs come from out of state. So when the supporters of hydrofracking say it's going to be the economic boom, that's actually not correct. The state that will benefit from hydrofracking in New York State is actually Texas, because that's where most of these people come from. They come in, it takes 3 months to drill a well, and then they're gone. I mean, they travel from state to state and actually country to country. The only job benefit that we'll get will be the local deli owner or the local hotel owner, why these workers are here, but that's very temporary in nature. So within the next couple of weeks, we fear that the governor and DEC could release regulations. What we are continuing to fight to ban, you know, hydrofracking in New York State, which is my legislation. I don't believe there could be any, no regulations could be strong enough to prevent the disasters from happening.
That's actually the title of my current alternate piece, which quotes you. It's called "Why Safe Regulation of Fracking in New York is a Fiction." You know, because these industries are so powerful. So there's this, you know, it's a simple sentence. I think the real problem is one of an informed public, because it's a simple sentence to just deny everything and say it's safe, they've done it for 100 years, it's safe, rather than look into what it actually does and to go to the neighboring state and see it. And also, when you mention seismic activity, that should be of tremendous concern to New York City residents, because we are due south by, you know, half an hour or so, you know, from a nuclear reactor that we have in Indian Point, which is of the same model as the one that, you know, went off the track due to an earthquake in Japan. So, you know, that's
You're absolutely correct. I was at a civic meeting last night, and I was talking about hydrofracking. And one of the one of my constituents actually got up and said, "Yeah, look at all of the commercials that the oil and natural gas companies are putting on TV, spending millions of dollars to hoodwink the public into thinking this is safe." And we've done this for hundreds of years, which is actually not correct. This hydrofracking process is relatively new, because we're running out of places where we can get natural gas, drill for natural gas easily. The process is basically releasing natural gas from the shale deposits wherever they may exist in the country. And obviously, the Marcellus shale deposit in New York State is a huge concentration of possible natural gas. But to get it out, we have to pump into the ground, as you know, very toxic chemicals, 50% of which only is recoverable. So that means 50% of all the toxic chemicals stay in the ground. And because you're literally creating fissures in the shale, it gives the opportunity for this toxic waste to rise to the ground and into the water supply.
As a senator representing a constituency in New York City, I wanted to, you know, ask you specifically about, you know, there's a sense in New York City that, oh, this is all going on upstate in some other region. Yes, we know that our water comes from up there, but we've been assured by Mayor Bloomberg and Governor Cuomo that they'll kind of draw a line around the New York City reservoir, and therefore, you know, there's no possibility at all that any of these things could find their way into the New York City unfiltered water supply. Is that geologically, you know, a real concern?
No, it's a real concern. And in fact, the original regulations proposed that the state came out with would prohibit a hydrofracking well 1,000 feet from the New York City watershed upstate and 4,000 feet from a natural reservoir. That is nothing. Mm-hmm. That's meaningless. And originally, the New York City Department of Environmental Protection actually recommended, I think it was like 7 miles away from the watershed. The state, to my knowledge, has not changed their position on this. What is fascinating is that the mayor now comes out in support of hydrofracking, when his own city commissioner actually said that the regulations were not strong enough to protect the watershed. You know, 1,000 feet from the watershed is absurd.
That's a joke, really.
Mm-hmm. And remember that these wells are horizontal. You drill down vertically, but then the wells go horizontal under the ground. So they can go for a mile or two underground, even though the actual well head, which you see above ground, may be, you know, 4,000 feet or 1,000 feet away. But what's going on the ground could be much closer. And water has a way of finding of its own level. And the water mixed with very toxic chemicals eventually could, and I believe would, get into the water supply. And I think your listeners have to understand that in addition to the very toxic chemicals that are pumped into the ground, which, by the way, the oil and natural gas companies never release what the chemicals are and their quantities, they all consider that proprietary information, like secret. Mm-hmm. And nobody can force them to do it, to release that information. Radon, which is a radioactive material, is a naturally occurring element in the ground, but it's very deep. But part of the drilling will go into the radon areas, and the radon then gets released along with the toxic chemicals, and it comes up with the wastewater. Mm. So, and the half-life of radon can be 1,000 years. So if that radioactive material gets into the water supply, we will have a very serious issue with drinking water in not only in New York City, but upstate. And we are very fortunate that we have some of the best drinking water in the country. It always wins tests when contests across the nation. Why would we want to jeopardize that for a few jobs, temporary jobs, and some revenue? Two interesting points that I want to mention in that context. One, you know, the oil and natural gas company keeps saying, well, this is going to reduce our dependency on foreign oil. Mm-hmm. Oil and natural gas are two different things. They're like comparing apples and oranges. And the oil and natural gas companies are already planning to build pipelines to send this natural gas overseas. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to benefit by low prices. It's just this fallacy that somehow this is going to improve, you know, the oil situation for the entire country.
You know, it's so interesting that you say that, because it seems so obvious, but I don't know that I've ever actually heard anyone else addressing it. But, you know, people, because what we put in our automobiles is called gas, you know, then there's this kind of thing in people's minds, we need to do this so that, you know, the price at the pump will be lower and I can drive my car. But in fact, it's not even the same product at all.
Correct.
you know, and so there just seems to be so much confusion about that. And I just also want to mention, you know, you said that the chemicals can migrate through fissures underground, and 7 miles was originally recommended, and we're nowhere near that in terms of the protection of the upstate water sources. I mean, there are studies that show that fracking chemicals can migrate for 17 miles, you know.
Right.
So, you know, it maybe it doesn't happen in the first hour, but it happens in, you know, in a month, in 6 months, and, you know, and then when it happens, the companies have gone, they've shrugged their shoulders, they say, it wasn't me, you know, I'm Mikey, it wasn't me. You know, what, and then we talk regulations, but what kind of accountability, you know, is it likely, would be recommended, so that if there are problems, who would be accountable?
Well, that's an excellent question, because they're exempt. The oil and natural gas companies are exempt from being sued for any possible contamination that may be caused by these, you know, hydrofracking processes. This is the most amazing thing, that we've allowed this thanks to Congress and the huge influence of money at that level, that they are exempt from oil and natural air and water regulations across the entire country. They're exempt from being sued for possible contamination from which they could cause. I've actually introduced a number of bills in the state legislature, which I'm fighting to get enacted. One which would include the hydrofracking processes, the wastewater, in the state's air and water protections. Also, that they would be liable, these companies, for any contamination. I've also introduced worker protection, you know, bill. There were so many things that we could do if we're going to allow this. It's interesting that I can't get support from the governor's office or DEC to support this legislation, and even the Republican Senate, which most of the people in support of hydrofracking are the Republican state senators from upstate, you would think that since they're so behind hydrofracking that they'd want to support my legislation, get it enacted. If they say it's safe, which they keep saying it is, then what are you afraid about passing these additional regulations? The oil and natural gas companies have the whole process stacked in their favor. Mm-hmm. So they can do basically whatever they want, and if they contaminate the area, they can't be sued. It's really incredible. And Josh Fox, who, you know, I'm sure your listeners know, was the producer of Gasland, was able to get from the oil and natural gas company's own internal documents, which showed that from day one, 6% of the wells will fail. In other words, they're casing to protect these toxic chemicals from getting into the ground and the water supply. 6% will fail from day one. So if you allow 100 wells, you know, the first day, 6% of them, 6 of them are going to fail, which means 6 sites in this state are going to be contaminated. And the number goes up over time, where over 30 years, 50% of the wells will fail. So it's a very dramatic, you know, figure that these things are just not safe.
So, the public, this is really astounding, Senator Avella, because the public statement is, we can regulate it to make it safe. But there you are, you know, so the federal level of regulations have been stripped away, no protection coming there. There you are at the state level introducing the kind of legislation that would help, create a bulwark, a protection for the public. And, you know, it's like pulling teeth to get support for it. So,
correct.
You know, so the announcement when, you know, during the 5 minutes of a public meeting that's then quoted and quoted and here and there is, we'll regulate it to make it safe. But what's actually going on the ground in the state Senate and the state Assembly is that they don't want to. They won't do it. So that's really the conundrum there.
Well, I also, you know, as much as the governor has said, mm-hmm, that he'll, you know, make the final decision on hydrofracking based upon the science. Mm-hmm. Well, the science isn't there. So we have all these regulations we could put into effect. We have all this data now we could review, and we're not doing it. It just really is amazing to me. But then it comes down to what we talked about earlier, the huge influence of big money in government. And until we make some real reforms in terms of public financing and eliminating the influence of big money, we're never going to be able to protect our environment or do the right thing by the citizens of this state or the country.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. We're going to have to take a break for station identification, but please stay with us, listeners. I'm talking today with Senator Tony Avella of New York's 11th District, state senator in the New York State Senate, and public reformer, protector, and defender. We're talking about fracking. Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots, the second half of the show. Allison Rose Levy, journalist and blogger on the Huffington Post, Alternet, and bringing you the show every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Today, we are talking with Senator Tony Avella. He's a state senator from the 11th District in Queens in the New York State Senate and a champion of public health and protection in the face of prospects or threats or risks to frack New York State. So welcome back to the second half, everyone, and Senator Avella, so glad again to have you with us. In the first half of the show, one of the things you said that I wanted to pick up on and kind of get into a little bit more is that there's been a delay because of this, in quotes, so-called health analysis, which, as you point out, pointed out in the earlier half of the show, is quite incomplete. You know, you gathered these renowned experts, you asked them to assess health, but instead of asking them to actually look at health and all of the things that could be a threat, instead they're looking at a document created that doesn't really, for all we have seen of it thus far, mention or analyze health. So, as you pointed out, that's like asking them to look at nothing.
I mean, it is, incredible that we've asked these scientists, and I basically, I think it was the way that the DEC had to address the concerns that I and many of my colleagues and the environmental groups had about, and health professionals, that they weren't looking at the health impacts of hydrofracking. During the budget hearings, for example, the State Department of Health Commissioner said that all he's looking at with these three scientists is what's in the proposed regulations. So that's when the DEC testified. I asked the commissioner, Commissioner Martens, I said, well, you're asking them to look at nothing because, and the commissioner wouldn't even ask me. I said, how many pages are in the report to deal with health impacts? Is it a couple of pages? Is it a couple of paragraphs? I never even got an answer. And then the commissioner comes back to me and says, well, we've also asked them if there's nothing for the, if they need more data, they can say that. And I said, well, that's not what the health commissioner said. So it's the left hand is saying, you know, is saying something different than the right hand. And it's just a real disgrace that nothing is being done to assess the health impacts.
Now they have delayed for an indefinite, I don't know how long it's a matter of conjecture for how long
they
last.
Yeah, the commissioner, DEC Commissioner Montaigne said it could be a couple of weeks. Many of us feel that once you miss the deadline, you have to go totally back to square one and a new set of public hearings and, you know, and a completely new public review process. Obviously, this DEC is denying that that has to be done, but we're going to continue to fight. And there will be, I don't want to speak for the environmental groups, but we're not going to let this go without a lawsuit.
There have been a number of groups that have come forward, Sierra Club and others, saying this cannot stand. For one thing, just the secrecy that you mentioned, this is supposed to be a public, transparent process. That's part of the whole process of developing the guidelines upon which the regulations are based. And yet, even though there was a kind of reissue of guidelines back in December, nevertheless, the actual contents of what they're working from and what will be proposed remains a secret, both in terms of its health aspects and other aspects. How can that be when this is supposed to be a public dialogue process.
Well, it's been very little public dialogue. It's been very little public discussion. And you bring out an interesting point. The first draft of the state's regulation to allow hydrofracking, before it was released to the public, and the environmental groups, was pre-leaked, given to the oil and natural gas companies.
Oh, my.
Which is an absolute disgrace. Now, when we found out about it, we, I and the environmental groups, and I believe a number of senators signed on to a letter with me saying to the commissioner, how is this allowed to happen? And the response back was, well, by law, we're supposed to share these type of regulations with interested parties. I have followed, that response with a request, show me in the law where it says that. And I don't think I've gotten a response yet. I think it's highly irregular to share proposed regulations with the very people you're supposed to be monitoring before you release it to the public. That, to me, is an abuse of the system. So, and after they finally did release the first draft, there were like 80,000 public comments. I mean, that's an unbelievable number. That's when they came out with the revised draft. Now they've had over 200,000 comments on the revised draft. Mm-hmm. Now, it took them almost a year to review the 80,000 comments. Mm-hmm. They've only had a chance to review the 200,000 comments in like a couple of months. And this is one of the questions I asked of the commissioner during the budget hearings. How could you possibly do that? It took a year to look at 80,000 comments. How can you do in a couple of months review 200,000 comments?
But when they so-called reviewed the 80,000 comments, when they re-released the guidelines in December, people who looked very closely at this extremely extensive document said that there was very little change from the original document before the 80,000 comments were issued. So, are they obligated by law to take into consideration? And, what are public comments? Anyone who goes on the internet and reads blog comments, knows that they can range from, somebody saying, you're an idiot and I'm not, or whatever, to, in the case of I was present when meetings were held, both in New York City and upstate, where people read comments and offered comments and offered, some people, professionals with scientific, geological, legal, public health, and other specialties, offered very well analyzed data. That's part of the comments too, not just,
right,
the neighbor saying I want it or I don't want it.
Well, they're obligated by law to review each comment, at least in the first, after the first draft was released. Mm-hmm. But they're not obligated to listen to anybody, mm-hmm, which is the sad part of it. And you're correct in saying that a lot of people and a lot of environmental groups did really substantial research on the entire document and submitted some very important revisions. And many of them were just, like, ignored.
So if they jump back up from this and say, okay, dust myself off 2 weeks later, now we've done the health analysis and we're ready to reinitiate the process, there's legal problems with that because aren't they mandated to reopen the entire process rather than just pop
no.
up?
Well, no. We think yes. I mean, mm-hmm, we think yes, but mm-hmm, they're saying no.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, from the very beginning, the state has really bungled this. And I always keep referring to the governor's statement, he'll make a decision based upon the science. Mm-hmm. Well, we haven't done that. We haven't looked at the science. It's just the single most, what I consider to be the single most important environmental issue that this state has faced in 100 years, and the ramifications, of course, the negative ramifications, could be with us for the next 1,000 years. We have just totally botched this in terms of looking at the ramifications of hydrofracking. And unfortunately, the decision at a very high level was made, let's go ahead with this, instead of should we even do this in the first place? That should have been the public review and the public comment. Do the people of this state want hydrofracking or not? But a decision was made very early on. Yeah, we want to do hydrofracking. Let's see what we can come up with to mitigate any problems. But that's not the way you decide to do something. Mm-hmm. You've already made that decision, and I basically tried to get the commissioner to admit that during the budget hearings, and he feigned ignorance. I just don't think he realized what I was saying. We should never have gone ahead with this until we made an analysis of, do we want to do this or not?
Mm-hmm. So they're basically proceeding to how we do it.
Correct.
Before going through, should we do it?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Absolutely correct. And that's a major flaw in how the state proceeded to move on this issue.
So even if they found stuff right now where, you know, it was like, wow, this, we can't mitigate this, we can't control this, what can we do? They've made it even hard for themselves.
Correct.
Should they free themselves from this outside influence and really see all of the evidence that points toward the tremendous level of harm and risk that would ensue, they're kind of a bit trapped in terms of how they would backtrack from that.
Well, and unfortunately, within government, and again, as you mentioned early on, I've worked in government for some time, even before I was elected to public office. It's like a snowball rolling downhill. Once they start something, it's very hard for them to backtrack or stop. Mm-hmm. And now it's almost like they have to justify, okay. No, whatever happens, we can mitigate it. And of course, that's not the case in this process. And whether or not you can mitigate it, even if you could, the expense is going to be enormous and the damage to the environment is going to be enormous and could be with us for a long, long time.
And who's paying that expense?
You and I. The taxpayers will pay it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting what you're saying, too, about, going on old information and then being kind of stuck because of the difficulty of kind of turning on that. Because one of the three health reviewers, the experts who came around the country to participate in the analysis that you describe, offered a webinar, about a couple of weeks back. And this was several months after this gentleman was one of the three who had, reviewed all of the data that was provided to him. And then he, a month or two down the line, he does this webinar where he is teaching others about the risks of hydrofracking and kind of displaying his degree of knowledge of the topic. And this was analyzed by some of the scientists and geologists and others who closely follow all of the current research on these issues in the state and found to contain many inaccuracies and flaws. And the health care professionals of New York, which is a group of physicians and others, did an analysis of it, and I was looked at their analysis and also looked at the webinar, and the thing that struck me was that this sounds like what the environmental groups who were slow to see the problem with fracking and get on board, but who now, with just a few exceptions, really are very deeply concerned about it and consider it an absolutely must not do. 5 years ago, before they'd done their research, they were saying the things that this gentleman, this expert, was teaching in his webinar, which he may well have gotten from reviewing the documents upon which New York is basing its decision. So right now, the Department of Environmental Conservation, could be in the position, based on what you're describing in this evidence, of going forward with outdated science, outdated understandings, and they can't. How do they turn that around?
And that's one of the major problems here is that they made a decision early on, and they're just now going to justify the decision they made in the first place. And I think you make a good point, too, about some of the early decisions of some of the environmental groups, mm-hmm. which saw, hydrofracking as a way to get rid of coal.
That's right.
Now they're, after all this research and the experience in other states, now they have reversed themselves in realizing this is a much more dangerous process.
Right. Right. And but New York, the bureaucratic process there is much harder to turn around.
Correct.
You know?
Well, I was talking about was the environmental groups that were originally, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. supporting it. Now they realize, well, wait a second, this looks like it could be worse than coal is.
Right. Right. And contributing to climate change.
Correct.
In very serious ways. You know, the other thing I just wanted to touch on, too, a friend recently, his building was converted to natural gas for, I think, heating and stove, you know, for the stoves and everything. And they've, you know, they've been there, and these kinds of conversions are going on in New York City. And he was noticing a lot of foul odors, and, you know, we were conjecturing, you know, what would happen if radon is coming in through natural gas to the stoves of apartment dwellers and homeowners all over New York. And he was noting an unaccustomed foul burning odor, not sure really where it came from. The people who, you know, are kind of, you know, kind of manning the building, they're not obviously very well informed about all of these mechanicals. And there was really no one to call. And so, you know, I was saying to him, well, you should call 311. But I mean, what could happen in a place like New York if, for example, everyone reconfigures to natural gas and it carries the radon that you mentioned in the first half of the show with the, you know, long half-life down to the city, and suddenly in stoves all over the city, people are inhaling it, they're experiencing problems. I mean, who would be on tap to answer questions, check, remediate, or deal with any problems that could arise?
Well, right now, no one, you know, and that's what we would have thought would have been in this initial, you know, regulations that DEC was proposing to how do you deal with all of these issues? And instead, you know, they chose to go ahead with, you know, well, there really is no impact. There really is no health impact. There really is no negative effects, and we can do this. And we've only begun to scratch the surface, and I think what you just brought up is another interesting aspect of this. And, of course, it would be on local, you know, on New York City government, for example, which obviously has the resources to start dealing with these issues, but what about all the local municipalities upstate that might have this as well? I mean, I can't overemphasize how dangerous this is. And I first got involved in this hydrofracking issue when I was actually in the New York City Council. Mm-hmm. And I tried to get this, I introduced a resolution in the City Council asking the state legislature to introduce a ban on this. And I couldn't get the City Council to pass my ban resolution. It's funny how it never occurred to me that it would take me getting elected to the Senate to actually go to Albany and introduce the ban bill myself.
Well, thank you for doing that on behalf of everybody. You know, one more question. It's like if some of these things start happening and these costs start accruing, will, you know, with a great boon of tremendous wealth that's, you know, supposedly coming as a result of this activity, will it be taxable to any, you know, you've stated already these companies won't be accountable for turning around and dealing with damage, but will it be taxable and bring in the kind of flow of revenue that will allow the city of New York and local municipalities to address some of these problems, or they're going to be sitting there with an empty pocket when this stuff hits the fan?
Again, a very good point. The amount of revenue that we will get from this will be minuscule in terms of any environmental remediation that we would have to do. And don't forget the health impact. So if there were major, even a few, accidents where people's health are affected, the impact to the healthcare system in the state will be huge. And all of this has, you know, a financial bottom line. And the amount of money we're going to generate from this will be wiped out in the first two or three accidents completely. And, you know, I also want to mention that where these wells will go upstate are basically they're approaching landowners, farm owners. Mm-hmm. And a lot of farms upstate are in financial trouble. They're basically barely making it. So to some farm owners, this may seem like a huge financial windfall. But, and they sign the lease, they get this initial lump sum payment, and then they're supposed to get royalties over time. It's been the experience in Pennsylvania where these royalties never seem to happen. They get this initial lump sum, which everybody thinks is great, but then you get your water supply damaged. So now you have to deal with bottled water. And there are towns in Pennsylvania and property owners who now get all of the water for drinking, bathing, washing dishes, washing clothes from bottled water because their wells are contaminated. Mm-hmm. Their property value has dissipated to zero. Mm-hmm. So you may get this initial influx, this lump sum payment, which may seem a lot to them, but in the end, you don't get any royalties. You have to deal with contaminated water, and then your property value disappears completely. So there really isn't this financial boom that the oil and natural gas companies are saying. You know, it's and again, it's not the real fix that upstate needs in terms of economic revitalization. Mm-hmm. Wherever the wells go in, it's going to be a temporary fix. And what's also not discussed is most of these wells are going to be in hard-to-reach places. So you're destroying part of the wildlife. You're taking down trees. You're now going to have to you create roads to get to these well sites. And the toxic chemicals that are pumped into the ground, well, they have to be trucked in every single day, hundreds of trucks. So throughout New York State, you're going to have these tanker trucks with very toxic chemicals being trucked in every day. And there are, it's been reported in other states where there are truck accidents and you have all these toxic chemicals spilling onto the local streets. Mm-hmm. Do we want this? I don't think so.
You know, the other piece of it, too, because I got into covering the environment from a health perspective. I, for many years, have been a health journalist and writer and all of that. And the other concern is, you know, if we're trying to lower our carbon footprint, use less foreign oil, not drive around so much, not truck stuff around so much, here you, on the one hand, have this massive increase in trucking. But the other thing is that it's most economical and environmentally friendly for New Yorkers to buy New York State or regional food. And this is the very area where all of this agriculture exists and where all the food for our big city is grown, that you know you're going to be pumping all this toxic chemicals into the land and into the earth. And
That's right. In fact, I've had a number of organic farmers, which is the new industry upstate. I mean, agriculture is the biggest industry upstate, but organic farming is something that's come upon, you know, the area for the last 10 years. And a number of those farm owners have told me, with their outlets being in New York City, they've been told by their outlets, you know, the restaurants, food establishments, whatever, that even if they don't have a well on their property, if they're anywhere near a hydrofracking well, they're not going to purchase their product.
And that means there's a loss of one industry at the expense of another, and then there's a net loss to New Yorkers of the healthy food that we, you know, love and need. You know, we're coming near the end of our show time today, and I just want to thank you so much, Dr. Tony, you know, doctor, I've given you a doctor's degree, Senator Tony Avella, both for the incredible work that you have been doing and are continuing to do to protect New Yorkers. You're our hero, and also for being with us today and sharing your in-depth knowledge of this issue on Connect the Dots. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for allowing me to sort of tell your listeners about this issue, because it is the most important environmental issue we face. So it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. And thank you, listeners, for being with us today. Tune in next week for the next edition of Connect the Dots, Wednesdays, every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And if you've enjoyed this program, it will be available shortly in the Connect the Dots archive on radio. And please pass it along to your friends. Like it in iTunes. You know, this is the best way to, I think, the show. Senator Avella's description really orients people to everything they need to know about fracking and our current risks with it and what he's doing along with others to help protect us. Be with us next week. Thanks for listening.
Don't let